Mr. Stephen Green, I appreciate you for stopping on through. You know, we are connected through many, several, you know, avenues. You know what I'm saying? Your wife, she did the pictures at my wedding 9 years ago. You know what I'm saying?
Man, 9 years? Jeez, can't believe it's been so long.
Right. You know, and my little brother and your oldest, well, actually, your kids grew up together.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Let's start before all that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How did the journey start for you? You know what I'm saying? Like, where you're from? How'd you get out west? If you're not out west, you know what I'm saying? Like, how did you kind of, you know, make these moves to get to where you're at today?
Yeah, man. Born in San Francisco, in the city. I'm the youngest of five boys. And I was actually born June 5th, 1977, which is in Portland date, because that's the day the Trailblazers won their first and only championship. So I was born at halftime. And then, you know, we having such a large family, you know, my mom's from New York from Puerto Rico by way of New York. And then my dad's from East Side Detroit. And so, you know, having five knucklehead sons, didn't go back to Detroit, you know, full time. That was kind of problematic. And so my parents decided to take a risk on this place in Portland. So when I was 3 months old, we moved up to Portland. So born in the Bay, but only lived there for a very, very brief minute. And then, you know, I think having a childhood where I split time between here and Detroit has really been the thing that's probably informed me the most, besides my parents. My dad was a high school dropout. Dropped out of high school, went into the service, was in Vietnam, learned a bunch of things there. And then when he was stationed in San Francisco, he met my mom. And then my mom, you know, Puerto Rican, software engineer, got into Stanford. You know, they really molded the person that you see today. Both people super duper committed to community. You know, I learned knowledge from my parents living in Portland, living in Beaverton at the time. We saw somebody look like us, they got the nod. And, you know, all the family that I have here in Oregon, none of them is blood family, but they're all family, if you know what I mean. So, you know, my parents, best friends, coworkers from the 70s and the 80s, that's our family today. And so all my cousins, aunties, uncles that I grew up with, you know, all people that started with the nod, either in the grocery store or at work or something like that. And so, you know, my parents, they knew about the hustle. You know, my dad, even though he dropped out of high school, got his GED while he was in the service, went on to work at Intel, went on to start a company. Both my parents were founders while I was a kid. And so that got normalized. When I was living in Detroit, you know, I'd stay with my uncle who was a pharmaceutical sales rep. You know, and not the legal kind. But, you know, the hustle is the hustle. And so, you know, love living here, but also love traveling. I think the more I travel now as an adult, the more I appreciate, you know, being here in Portland, what we got.
For sure. And I definitely get the idea of, you know, we're not blood family, but, you know, I see you in a store, you know, like, especially if we live together, you know what I'm saying? Like you try to want to kind of build that network, you know what I'm saying? I really didn't understand the importance of that until, like, my daughter went to school, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like when your kids go to school, wherever you're living at kind of becomes more cemented, you know what I'm saying? Because, because, like, you know, like, you get to know the, you know, the parents, the, you know, everybody, especially when you, and then, like, you know what I'm saying, you black or you person of color. So it's like, if you see another one, it's like, hey, like we at least got to talk for 5 minutes. You know what I'm saying? Like,
exactly.
You know what I'm saying? So we can kind of figure out, you know, like, you know, if this is going to be something that we can kind of build on or not. Right. So like, how did your career start? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, schooling, first job, you know, first, you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, this is
what, amazing. First job. Wow.
Well, you know, like, not like, you know, Dairy Queen, but like, you know, like the first time, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you had the idea, like, oh, well, you know, this might be something.
You know, I always knew early on, like, I had a proclivity for numbers. You know, even before I knew what a spreadsheet was, I was making spreadsheets out of my baseball card collection, right? And so I'd, like, log, like, this is what I got the card for. this is how much it's worth in April of, you know, 1980, whatever, and then change it over time. And so, you know, numbers always spoke to me. And so when I went to college, I got my degree in economics. And so that was really where, you know, this idea of like finance and helping people and speaking through numbers really, really came into sight for me. Started my first business when I was in college. I played football in college, but I wasn't on an athletic scholarship. I was on an academic scholarship. So there was a gap between like what my academic scholarship would cover and what I needed to pay for with my, you know, apartment or living with my house with some other teammates. And so I didn't have time in my hands. So I started a business. And so I sold shoes on eBay the last 2 years of school, paid for school, made like 30, 40 grand, just slanging stuff on eBay. And then once I got in my career, I went into the securities world, banking and finance. And I realized I love working with small business owners. And I love working with people that were early stage with their business that were like, I know what I want to do, but I'm not quite there yet. And, you know, I really found myself being the one that not only like cheered them on, but also was like, hey, this is, you know how to work in your business. I'm going to help you work on your business. And working on your business means having, you know, strong legal footing, having a good plan, knowing how to make a profit and knowing the difference between revenue and profit and cash, because we pay for everything with cash. And so it's been amazing. I think the most, you know, beneficial thing in my professional life has been playing a really small part in the journeys of a lot of the brands that we see today. Deadstock, Salt and Straw did the first loan ever for Kim over at Salt and Straw. And it's been really cool, you know, seeing people grow and evolve and build these brands that we love today. But it all started with someone having this idea. And, you know, I remember to this day when Ian had his idea for Deadstock. And I was like, yeah, that sounds kind of cool, even though you don't like coffee. you finally have your dream job that you wanted at Nike, but you're going to give it all up to go chase this idea of starting a community space called Deadstock. So to be along for the ride with so many different great folks and to start my own along the way has been really, really awesome. I think there's few things in life that are more satisfying than coming up with an idea at your living room table that complete strangers then go and give their hard-earned money for that harebrained idea, right? That's something I wish everyone got to experience in their life, where they take something from nothing to literally strangers give you their money. That's pretty dope.
I definitely can relate, because I remember like from recording the first Hip Hop Social Worker podcast and then getting like that first like, hey, do you want to come speak? You know, that was like, I was like, oh man, like, you know, kind of like that feeling of manifesting something, you know what I'm saying? Just the hard part is you got to manifest every day. People don't tell you that part.
No, man. And it's a grind. Like, you know, we had the gathering this week and right. It's interesting. You know, we had what, 300 people there, whatever. And to see people talk about it on social media, like it was great, or I wish I would have known or whatever. But what they didn't talk about was I've been doing gathering for 10 plus years. And most of the gathering events were 10 or less people. It wasn't some grandiose thing. And so it's interesting to see how people pay attention to things, or they become like in focus once they're like larger or established. But they don't ask about, or they don't even know to ask about, like all the times where there was just a handful of folks, or all the times where it was like we weren't making money on anything, or whatever the case may be. But once you make it, people feel like, oh, that just happened overnight. And it's like, nope, that's not the case at all. And right. You know, how much you got to show up along the way, right? And like, I really think big things are made out of grains of sand, and not a lot of people are willing to go and like place millions of grains of sand to try and build something. They want 300 people at their first event, right? And if they don't do it, then like it's not legit. Versus, you know, I think some of the smallest of gatherings have been some of the best ones, because you get this really, really intimate setting where you get to know people better.
Right. I feel like I have a theory about like why like people like want like big turnouts. The first go around, I feel like people are, not feel like, people suck at being vulnerable. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you can't never catch an L in public. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's why, like, sometimes you hear people's, like, kind of, like, their first testimony. It's like, yeah, I just had this idea, and it kind of blew up overnight. And then, like, the 80th time they tell that story, it's like, yeah, it took me, like, 7 years. Like, you know, like right. You know, like, you know, where to get cemented, you know what I'm saying? Like, the more honest they are about it, you know what I'm saying? I feel like people are just scared to catch that L in public, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, people who are out here actually doing the work, you know that the first one might be a dud. The first seven might be a dud, you know what I'm saying? But you got to keep showing up, because number 8 might be the one, or number 20 might be the one, you know what I'm saying? But you never really know until you got to keep putting that work in. But
yeah,
I'm going to go back. You said you made 30 or 40 grand back in 2003 or something like that?
2002, 2003, 2001.
On eBay? So like,
yeah, so eBay was relatively new. So I was always going to work at Nike. Like that was the goal. I grew up, my parents' house is a mile from campus. Like everyone I grew up with, their parents or them ended up working at Nike. When you live in Beaverton, like you're always adjacent to Nike in some way, shape or form. My aunt actually opened and ran the first outlet store on MLK, which opened back in the '80s. But then once I got adjacent to the culture, it wasn't a good fit for me, but I realized I like shoes. And I used to go and hang out. There was a store that closed in the '90s called the Athletic Department in Beaverton. It was in Beaverton Mall. And it was a Nike, you know, retail shop. Not run by Nike. It was a privately owned little wholesale shop. And I used to go and talk to the owner all the time. And during the summer, I just go hang out with him. We talk shoes. Because I couldn't talk shoes in business with a lot of people. And so I just soak up game from him. And one day he was showing me, he had a spreadsheet. I love my spreadsheets. And I was like, oh, what's that list? He's like, oh, every week Nike sends me this spreadsheet and it's of shoes that are available through their warehouse. And I was like, oh, how does that work? He's like, oh, so Nike sells shoes to Nordstrom's. And then when the season's over, Nike actually buys those shoes back so that the next season of shoes can go onto the shelves. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any room for them. So now I go through this list and I look for full size runs so that I can carry these shoes that are a season or two old, but not, they're still brand new shoes. They're just from, let's say, the fall and it's the summer now. And I was like, wow. So he showed me the spreadsheet and most of them wasn't full size runs. It was like one pair of this, three pairs of that, but a lot of stuff he couldn't get because he needed a full size run in the store. eBay was 2 or 3 years old at the time, and I knew product codes pretty well. So once I started going to the spreadsheet, I could see like, oh, that's a Jordan 14, or you know, that's a Jordan 17. So like the first thing that really ticked me off was there was a Jordan 17 low that was in white and purple. And when I saw the purple color code, I was like, there's not a general release 17, and I'm a size 12 and a half. Which happens to be the same size as Mike Bibby. So at first I was looking for shoes for me, and the shoes were based off of a discount of the wholesale price. So wholesale price is generally 50% of what a retail price was. This was a discount off of that wholesale price. So these shoes that were $150 brand new were like $62 or whatever on the spreadsheet. And it was a 12 and a half. I was like, I'm getting it. Turns out they were Mike Bibby's special PE, so a personal exclusive for him, and they were worth hundreds of dollars, but they're not worth anything to the guy that runs this store because he needs a full size run of something. So I went to eBay, and these shoes that I bought for 60 whatever bucks, I sold them for $300. And then I was like, man, let me go see if I can check this list out again. So, and it turns out at that point in time, Nike didn't have a bunch of outlets and things like that. They didn't have a place where all this inventory coming back could really go. And so it was available, and all you had to do was call Nike special orders and give them the number, and then you would just place an order there online. Oh, we're all over the phone. Excuse me. And so I did that. Man, I had a really great run. I think overall, after like 2 years of doing it, probably made like 55 grand in sales, and the margins were just crazy because I knew what I was looking for. and then selling it on there. I remember my dad came in with $500. He's like, hey, I want in on this too. Cause it was going so well. And he was like, why do you have all these shoes always? And you're not wearing them. Like, what are you doing with them? And I was like, oh, I'm buying them and I'm flipping them. And so at its peak during my second summer doing it, I was probably selling 40, 50 pairs every week. And so I was going to the post office all the time. They knew me by name. Like, and then what really ended it was the list started getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then fakes started hitting eBay. And so, you know, I wasn't selling like white Air Force Ones. I was selling,
right,
you know, Jordans or whatever, higher end things. And so once fakes started coming, it really diluted the ability to make really good margins on eBay. And, you know, I still had school and like ultimately a job to get and stuff like that. And so it didn't work for me anymore. But while it was a good run, like it was great. It was great.
Right. That's crazy that you could like call and get PEs like that. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
like you can never dream of doing that now. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, because like, the wholesale didn't know the difference, right? So like the people that ran Nike special orders, all they knew what was in the warehouse, right? Mm-hmm. So all they had was a product number and the style or color code for it, right? But it wouldn't give them information of like, oh, this is a PE. All they knew was the shoe came back to the warehouse for whatever reason. And I knew the color code. And so they're like, yeah, we got it or we don't got it. Right. And so all this nuance that exists now just didn't exist back then. They were just trying to get rid of inventory.
For sure. So did you keep any?
I mean, I got the original Foamposites from 97 that, you know, University of Arizona came out and blew away the world with. I got a couple things. I also contracted for Nike for a long time, so I got some. They took good care of me. They took good care.
Okay.
And then now I take good care of my son, unfortunately. So.
Right. Right. Well, no, I'm saying like it's in the blood. You know what I'm saying? Like, unfortunately, like you said. So, but you said you never worked for Nike.
I've never been a black badge, as they would say. I've never been a black badge.
So how did you get in such close proximity to the sneaker community? I'm assuming people knew who you was because you was the guy with the PEs, but was there any kind of other connections that you made?
I think the other thing is just like growing up here, a lot of my friends from like high school and even college ended up working at, you know, working at Nike. And so I always knew, you know, somebody from high school or college or whatever that was already at the brand.
Right.
And then post college, I played football in college, but I was a basketball shoe tester for Nike. So I was on campus once a week, every Wednesday, testing shoes in the early 2000s. And so even while I was working in banking, I was still on campus all the time. And then a friend of mine and I started running intramurals for Nike on campus. And so we weren't employees, but we ran flag football, softball, basketball, you know, the competitive and non-competitive league of flag football, beach volleyball. When they needed refs, like we organized and or were the refs for all of their sports on campus at the Bo Jackson facility. And so through that, we're meeting people in sports marketing. I mean, that's how I met Ian originally, was telling him how terrible the basketball player he was, and him crying for fouls all the time. And now we're, you know, we've been homies almost 15 years about that.
Right. Like. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So, well, I mean, that's some good connections right there. You said it was never like a fit for you. How would you know that it wasn't a fit?
You know, I think one of the things I realized as I got a little older in my career, I'm the guy that likes to help get the plane off the ground and into the sky. But once the plane's at like 35,000 feet and smooth, that doesn't excite me anymore. And, you know, Nike's a really large established company. And so, you know, I realized like what motivates me to get out of bed is like the hustle of, will this work? You know, we haven't quite made it yet. And you know, obviously Nike being 20, 30, 40 years old at the time just wasn't a good fit for me. And I think there was just also some cultural cues there that just weren't a good fit for me personal at the time. Again, I got a ton of homies that are over there thriving today. I'll be over on campus later on this week, actually meeting with some friends for lunch. But my personal journey just hasn't taken me there in a full-time role as of yet.
For sure. And what kind of contract work was you doing with them? Like,
So my contract was to run all the intramurals. Yeah. That was all of it. Yeah. Occasionally we'd have some conversations with people in HR about like retention. I think one of the things that I've been pretty vocal about and come to understand more is like connecting with Black and Brown folks at any company, but in particular at a Nike or an Intel, like, why do you come? Why do you stay? What makes you leave ultimately?
Right.
And so ended up having conversations with people in HR around like, hey, how can we, you know, attract and retain Black folks in jobs? And oftentimes it had nothing to do with the employees. It was their partners, right? So like Chris has been crushing it at work. Everything's going great. And all of a sudden he puts in his notice and it's like, oh yeah, my partner, you know, she never found community here. And so, you know, all her friends are still in Cleveland where we came. So it's just easier for us to go back. Right. And so I think that's one of the missteps for a lot of these companies is they don't go and think about, all right, when we're hiring Chris, we're actually hiring Chris and his family, right? And right. So if we're going to go and spend all that money to bring him on, what do we do to make sure, you know, his wife feels like this is a good space for her as well? And so, you know, that's been one of the things that kind of manifested what we do with the gathering is it's a space for a lot of these people that work in predominantly white spaces to go and feel community. Even if it's only one day a month, they can go and tell themselves new narratives around what it means to live here and be Black here in Portland that maybe before going to the gathering, they'd have been like, yeah, no, there's no Black people here. There's no Black community here. All of a sudden, they're dropping into a rant on a random Wednesday and they see 50 brothers getting together for no other reason than just to get together. You know
right,
I mean?
Right, for sure. When you said partners, I was thinking like, you know, the business partners at Nike, because I did read an article saying that Tom Sachs is a wild dude, but I won't get into that though.
So I met him. Tom did a TEDx and he did TEDx in 2018, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a party. I was working at WeWork at the time and we did the after party at WeWork. And I can confirm he's a wild dude. Seems like a nice enough guy, but he had like three people that were like his entourage where they were like right. introducing him to people. It was the wildest thing. And now he's like, you know, seemingly some big deal. But it sounds like he's consistent, right? And I love, even if people are a little off or quirky, whatever, like I love consistent. Like don't let fame change you. Right. And I got a feeling like even if nobody knew who Tom was, he'd still be the same dude doing whatever he wants. Yeah.
For sure. I do appreciate that, you know. Let's talk about like Pitch Black and funding and things like that. But hold on, but first before we get into Pitch Black, you said you got Salt and Straw, their first loan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
Oh well, I was gonna say like when it comes to like getting business off the ground, there's a lot of information out here about like, you know, about funding, how to get your business off the ground, right? And a lot of people say, you know, you take an LLC, you get a loan, and you start that way, right? But a lot of people say, don't do that. Use your whatever kind of, however little amount of revenue that you make, use that to fund, right? You know what I'm saying? So, like, you being, like, in the business of starting companies and things like that, what would you, like, you know, suggest for someone? Because, you know, I did take the advice. I do have two credit cards that have a large... not large balances, but large, you know, just funds.
Available credit.
Because somebody said, take an LLC and, you know, use that in a private credit card. And I did that. And I did get some, you know, some funds. But I'm like, well, I don't know what to do with it. But, you know, how would you have somebody, you know, like move through those waters?
Yeah. I mean, everything with me starts with data, right? And so nationally, 0.3% of U.S. businesses will ever get equity, so like a venture capital investment of any kind, 0.3%. Nationally, 23% of U.S. businesses will ever get a loan. And so that means 70%+ of the time, all people do is take whatever money they got in their pocket and add it to this thing called customers, right? And the revenue they get from them. Like that's the most normal thing to do. When it comes to like what they should do, that depends on their business, right? So like a service business is going to run very different than a technology business, right? So with a service business, if it's just me and my hours, there's not a big disparity in me being able to go and devote my hours to it versus if I'm a tech company, well, I got to build an app first. And that app's going to cost $500,000. I can't go get revenue from customers to build this app because they're going to be paying for the app, right? And right. So that business idea, begets needing this capital infusion that most other businesses don't need, right? And so I think what I always tell people is, know the difference between what you want versus what you need. And I think the dangerous spot that we find ourselves sometimes with new business owners is we're in a moment now where we've really glamorized raising money and raising capital. And I think, I talk with a lot of founders that think they need to raise money to validate their business idea, versus the only money that can validate your business idea is customer, right? And so, figure out what are the barriers in you being able to get money from customers. And if that means you have to go and find $50,000 to hire a developer or something like that, then that may be the case. But the data says overwhelmingly, most businesses don't need a loan. They don't need equity investment. They need customers. They need you to figure out, how you're going to go and get market share from the current competitors in the market. So I think that's where people should always be spending their time.
How you going to get the funds? I like that. Because everybody sensationalizes entrepreneurship and LLCs and stuff like that, which it sounds lovely. I mean, I have one, you mentioned an end, got his dream job and left it, to build the fabulous brand of Deadstock Coffee, but obviously everybody won't or can't do that. So like, how do you feel about this kind of world of everybody should be an entrepreneur?
I feel like everybody should get the opportunity in their life to experience making something from scratch. Whether that thing lasts for 30 years and you pass it on to the next generation, or whether it's something you do for a summer where you see an opportunity and you got some time on your hands and you do something at a farmer's market, I think that those things are the exact same thing. And so being able to experience that and that being something that you do for the rest of your life are two very different things. And so, I always tell founders, like, figure out what chapter you're in your life, Ian found himself in a chapter where it was like, I want to build something from scratch. He recently announced he wants to go work back in the industry, right? That doesn't mean he's not taking an L with Deadstock. And even if he did, like, he got to live that dream for 7+ years, right?
Right.
And so I think it's about being honest with yourself and figuring out what you really want. And I think for a lot of folks that are thinking about becoming founders, if they're honest with themselves, what they're really looking for is to be important or to be seen or to validate some kind of thing that they can talk about on social media, as opposed to, when you're building the business, you want to be solving a problem and like be thinking right. about like, who, if I go and make this thing that no one's asking for, who am I helping? And if it's only yourself, then you're doing it for the wrong reason. And so I think that's the cool part about working with founders is I get to work with people that are like, hey, there's this thing that I always had a problem with, or I couldn't find, and I found these other 100 people that have the same problem, and I want to solve that issue for them. That's very different than I want to be popular. I want to have 50,000 followers on Instagram. I want to be in the Portland Business Journal, that kind of thing. Right. So if people can figure out their why, then the what is so much easier, right? It's just, are you willing to do the what? And I think where people fail in doing the what is they've never had a firm grasp of their why.
Right, right. That's some good game. Speaking of, shout out to Ian, because there's something, the grind is tough, And there's something like just kind of soothing about just waking up and going to a job for a few years, Just slowing down for a little bit, waking up, go to work, come home, Because it is a grind. Even like to sell one t-shirt, You know what I'm saying? It takes so much like promotion, you know what I'm saying? Or so I can imagine, like, when you got to fly here, you got to speak here, you got to do this. I mean, it's fun, you know what I'm saying? I can assume it's fun, but it's just, that stuff, you know, like the body does keep score, you know what I'm saying? No matter what you're doing. Sure. So I can see how one morning it's like, you know what? It might be nice to go back to an office and just kind of, you know, build another company, you know what I'm saying? And then, you know, because you're still going to add to your resume, you know, like you know, it's all like adding to, you know, whatever you do, it's all about, you know, building your profile up, no matter if you're working for yourself or if you're working for somebody else, you know what I'm saying? Yep. If you're doing it right, your profile is going to, you know, keep continuing to grow. But a Pitch Black. So the first time we talked about Pitch Black was 2 years ago, maybe last year. We had that meeting at a concourse and you said that, you know, Pitch Black started because your friends wanted funding, so you had like a fundraiser, and the first person who won got like $700, right? Yeah. That was like, that's all you raised. And now it's like a nationwide, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know you've done it in Philly. I know you've done it in San Francisco.
Austin, Seattle. Yeah.
So, you know, so how did that grow to like what it is now? You know what I'm saying? Last year, I saw you did a big, you know what I'm saying, the two brothers won, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, seeing, creative homies.
Yeah, I've been seeing them around, you know, seeing, they do great work, you know what I'm saying? And next year, I'm coming for some money, brother.
Hey, holler at your boys. There's very few things I had control over. Pitch Black is one of those few things.
Right. So, like, you know, let's talk about the story of that, you know, growing into what it is now.
I think, you know, originally, so I started a brew pub with some friends in Northeast back in 2013. And in 2015, when we started Pitch Black, it was based on the realization that, you know, I was looking at some census data. We had over 4,000 Black businesses in Oregon. I was like, what? Like, that's, I feel pretty informed. And I had no idea there was that many. And also in 2015, the show Shark Tank was pretty popular, where people go and pitch in front of VCs. And so with our brew pub, we have an event venue. And I was like, oh, I got a space that I can use for free. And I would love to hear more about the Black businesses that are in the area. And so I put out a call for folks that wanted to come either pitch the business idea or a business that they already have. And my hope was just to introduce people in Portland to some of the Black businesses and Black talent that we already have here. And so that first event, it was magic, man. It was just, there was an energy in that room, even though it was about, I think we had like 80 or 90 people that showed up. But from the first pitch, like, it was like, all right, there's something to this. And then one of my friends that was there, he's an engineer at Microsoft, but he's a big, big person on Twitter. And he was like, oh, I can tweet. And I was like, all right, cool, tweet. Like, I don't do post some pictures. And the event ended up trending on Twitter that day. And I heard from all these other cities that were like, oh, when are you going to do our city? When are you going to do here? And I guess I just assumed when we started it, you know, that it would only work in Portland because we have a small, you know, Black population. And so to hear from places like Detroit and New York and Philadelphia, people hit me up from Texas. I was just assuming, like, you've already got to have something similar to this. And so that led into the conversations of going and looking at other cities. But the other thing was, you know, I thought about, like, what if we did this a little bit bigger? And so the next year we did it at Instrument. We raised, I think, $15,000 for the winners that year. And it was just as good, if not better, the second go around with, you know, a couple hundred people. And then we kind of leveled up every time. This past year, we did it at the Reeser Performing Arts space out in Beaverton. 550 tickets. It sold out. We had another 110 people on the waiting list. And then we were able to give away between the winners, and then we use Black contractors to perform all the work. So T-shirt designs, we bought all the swag from Black businesses, photography, everything's provided by a Black business. And so we were able to, for that event, get out over $100,000 into the pockets of Black business owners here in town, full stop. And that's the big goal, is like, how do we put more money in these Black businesses' pocket while also, you know, putting them in the on stage to be able to be in the spotlight in front of the ecosystem here. And so continuing to do it more, heading out to Detroit later on this month to talk to the Black Footwear Forum around about Pitch Black and doing an event there. Headed to Philadelphia next month to go talk about, you know, the Black and Latinx businesses that we have here in Portland and talk a little bit about Pitch Black. So it's been a ton of fun, man, but I've learned a ton as well about how other ecosystems work and kind of some of the things that keep Black businesses from going and reaching, you know, and going and growing from one city to another. And so much is just social capital. And so whenever we do an event in another city, we always bring Black businesses from other cities with us. So when we're in Seattle, we have three or four of the people pitching from Portland so that they can go and make connections in Seattle for what they're trying to do.
Yeah, for sure. And like, do these cities reach out to you like, hey, you know, I'm saying, I heard what you did. I want you to come to Austin, you know, during South by Southwest. I don't know what else happens, but, you know, and have Pitch Black.
They do, or they'll reach out and be like, hey, we're going to do something similar. So I had to get, you know, Pitch Black trademarked. I haven't enforced it yet, but, you know, some people just copy it. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like, I'm not trying to go after other folks, but I also want to make sure I have to oftentimes, you know, just make clear, like, oh, I'm not part of this Pitch Black that's happening in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or something like that. And then I'll also end up going to those places and helping people figure out, like, what's the event for them to be able to engage with the Black businesses in their community, because it may look very different than Pitch Black. And so it's been cool being part of those planning conversations with different ecosystems and hearing about the things that they struggle with and how are they, you know, similar or dissimilar to what we're seeing here in Portland.
Sure. Okay. So what is like your role? So like, I know you mentioned Songstraw, Deadstock, and you said other companies that you've kind of helped get off the ground, but what is like your role been in those companies? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like as far as like, you know, helping them navigate their idea, bringing it to life, you know what I'm saying?
So I'm an angel investor. So I'll write small checks into companies. So I've got a handful of companies here in Portland and outside of Portland that I'm an actual financial investor in. But I'll also be either a board member or a board advisor, where I literally go and help them with their numbers, help with operations, help with legal structure. You know, Ian's case, helped him do his helped and paid for his trademark for Deadstock, the Flame logo and the name itself. And then really helping the business owner figure out, you know, because they're the ones that always know their product the best. I'm the one that knows about business structure or operations, because I've yet to meet a business owner that goes and says, I want to start this business so I can manage 20 employees, right? People don't say that, right? That's the stuff that comes with what they've chosen to do, but that's yet to be the focus of what they're trying to do. And so that's the stuff that they generally really, really struggle with, is processes, structure, procedures, and thinking about how to you know, avoid the negative externalities of what happened when you're scaling a business. And then after being a banker for, you know, 15 plus years, I've just got a lot of relationships. So when it comes to, you know, figuring out where to rent a space or which lawyer to use, or, you know, who can do your director, you know, your D&O insurance for your leadership team, I've done those things. I've been part of those transactions. And so I'm able to, you know, come help people, you know, not only answer their questions, but also help them ask them questions that they didn't even know to ask from the beginning.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Angel investor. All right. That sounds tight. So I should go to my, you know, tomorrow I should go to my mailbox and see, I got a check from, you know, some angel, you know, trying
to more money, more problems. So just know some of these angel investors, they will take your company from you. So
I can definitely imagine that. Like, hold on, fam. I gave you that money. Now it's time to, you know, you fight me in court? You can't. Well, then it's mine. So,
yeah. And this is one of the things, you know, I'll probably invest one out of 150 meetings where people, you know, pitch me, right? And the other 149 meetings generally go similar to, like, hey, this is how this works. Chris, right. You're asking for money. I'm going to give you a dollar. And for every dollar I give you, I want you to give me $10 back in the next 4 to 6 years. Mm, wow, that's a lot of money. How is your business going to be able to afford to do that? Because most businesses, there's not going to be, it's not generating enough profit to do something like that. And this gets into why so few businesses actually get equity investment. And the real reason why is very few businesses have the opportunity to return the kind of returns that are expected in a venture capital-esque deal, right? And so I have to help these business owners understand, like, okay, here's the expectations on my side. How are you able to afford that? There's really only two ways. You do an IPO or you sell the company, right? Or you sell some more of the stock in another fundraising situation where my funds, you know, the money that I've invested becomes, you know, worth more money.
Right.
But if they say, well, I'm not looking to sell the company, all right, that option's off the table. or they go and say, like, oh, like our revenue is potentially going to grow at 10% a year for the next 20 years. Well, you're not going to be spinning off enough profit for me to make my return on investment. So you may have an amazing business that's profitable and growing. It's just not a good fit for a venture type investment. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, just explaining the ABCs of how an investment works, and so that they can manage expectations when they do talk to an investor. And some investors may go and say, hey, I just want to see Chris be able to move forward. So I don't want a 10 times return. I'm not looking for that type of return. Maybe I just, you know, if you can pay me back, great. But if not, well, that's not a venture investment, right? You got an investor, but that's not a venture type investment. And I think people always need to be able to understand the difference between the reasons why someone is putting money into your company. A venture investor has, you know, is looking for a return on investment, and there are other opportunities for that same money. Those are the kind of returns that they're looking for.
Okay, man, I feel like, man, I feel like you break it down so, it's so needed, because I feel like people just, they tell you to get the LLC, they tell you to do all these things. But like when you talk about just investors, how, you know, you might have somebody who's willing to get, like you said, you know, here's their money. But then like, you know, like they might tell you here's 20K, but they won't tell you the part that, hey, I want $10 on a dollar back. You know what I'm saying? And it's probably buried in jargon, you know what I'm saying, in a contract. And if you don't read
well,
that
contract.
Well,
and it's not buried in jargon, right? Like, I mean, venture capital works pretty much the same that it always has, right?
Right.
And it only works in certain situations. And I think this goes back to how much we've glamorized entrepreneurship and fundraising, especially over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, that people just aren't asking those questions because they don't know what they don't know, right?
Right,
and so
right.
if I'm a venture investor and I've been doing this for years and it's always worked the same for me, I would assume that the person that's asking me to invest knows how it works, right? I'm not trying to be secretive or pull one by them. But if all of a sudden the person that wants my investment doesn't know that I'm looking for a 5 or 10x return, now I got questions about the business, because it sounds like they haven't done the research on me or what, you know, a venture investor does. And so I think that's one of the things that business owners, you know, I always push on, how do we get more information to business owners? Because if we can have more informed business owners, everyone else falls in line. Right. Because we can't have venture investors without business owners, but we can have business owners without venture investors. Right. So how do we get, you know, Ian and whoever else that may be thinking about taking an investment to know as much as possible so that they can manage expectations with the people that are across from them, across the table? Because in an ideal world, if you can't, you know, return 5 to 10x, you just shouldn't be talking to those folks. Right. You should be
That's
looking
true.
At your other options to get the money.
Right.
And so, but, you know, there's so little information out there, and generally, especially people of color, lack of the social capital that exists to be around those kind of things and to hear about it by happenstance. We're not at country clubs and things like that, where some of these deals might be getting talked about. Right. And the same thing goes for being an entrepreneur. There's a reason why 80% of entrepreneurs in the United States, one of their parents was an entrepreneur. It's been normalized through their life that being an entrepreneur is okay, right?
Right.
Versus if you didn't grow up around entrepreneurs, it seems extremely risky, right?
No, and you know, like you probably understand the grind too. You know, like this is a part of it. You know, because it is a grind. I feel like that part needs to be like highlighted.
It's,
you know, like
it's a grind, and like some people just can't not do it, right? So like, you know, Jelani from Akitsko, like if you ask him why he's a founder, he will tell you, like, because I am a terrible employee. Mm-hmm. I can't work for people.
Right.
It just, I'm not built that way, right?
Right.
And you know, I remember my dad used to tell us, like, there's two kinds of people in this world: those that sign the front of the check and those that sign the back. Generally, people don't do both, right?
Right.
And for the folks that are signing the front of the check, they own things, they own the business, they're taking on the risk. And the people that sign the back, they're collecting that paycheck. And there's nothing wrong with that, but right. It's a very different mindset. And I think for a lot of the folks that are entrepreneurs, they're either voluntary or involuntary entrepreneurs. We have a lot of people that, you know, maybe because they've been incarcerated or faced other things in their life, they can't go and get a 9-to-5 job like the rest of us, right? And so those kind of things exist as well.
For sure. Yeah, that's true. Speaking of 9-to-5s, you also have a pretty ironclad resume as well. You've been presidents of certain companies, CEO of certain companies, you know what I'm saying? How did you get to that position to where, like, you kind of pivoted, you know, or did you use entrepreneurship to kind of raise your profile so when you go to a company that's already established, you can say, hey, I can run this place. Just give me the job.
Yeah. To your point earlier, I think we're always building a brand for ourselves, whether we acknowledge it or not. And I think for me, you know, what's the secret sauce of my brand is that, like, I'm always going to be a community first person. I'm always going to, like, speak from an authentic voice. And I'm never one to just go along and get along. And I think part of why you see with my journey is so much filled with entrepreneurship or being part of startups is I'm not a go along and get along kind of guy to be at, you know, some big, you know, Fortune 500 company, because I have ideas and I do want to lead things and I want to find ways to be entrepreneurial, even if I'm working a 9-to-5 business. And a lot of times those aren't a good fit. And so I think, you know, because I have an amazing wife and we've planned the way we want things to be, it's, I function my best when I am in a position where I can be entrepreneurial. And so even if I did want to work at a place like a Nike or something like that, I know I'm not necessarily maybe a good fit unless it's a position where I can be pretty entrepreneurial and also, you know, kind of run things. And so I think it's hard to be an employee when you're kind of built to be the boss in certain respects. And I think I feel like I've gotten to a point in my career where, yeah, I do want to be the boss. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But also being the boss means you know, I think the most important attribute of being a boss means you're willing to serve, right? And willing to do a lot of the jobs that people aren't willing to do. And I think that's one of the things that people oftentimes don't associate with being the boss is that the boss gets stuck with all the crap jobs as well. Because when everyone else goes home, there's just you. And so it's like, all right, I guess somebody's got to take that trash out. It'll be me because no one else is here.
Right.
And so, you know, I would never associate, you know, being the boss or being the leader or whatever with the glamour. I associate it with, like, the buck stops with you. And, like, if you want people to follow you, you got to be willing to do all the things that maybe they think you're not willing to do. Like, when I was with the kids, I would go and work, you know, book fairs and stuff like that. And I remember, you know, I was with an employee one time and she was like, you're the CLO. Why are you here? I was like, because someone's got to be here. Like, that's the way it is.
I feel like because my family owned a business for a long time, my uncles, my great uncles, my dad's uncles,
what kind of business was it?
It was Coast Janitorial.
Okay, I didn't know you're part of their family.
That's my my grandpa, my uncles, those. But I feel like you said, like, you know what I'm saying, like, once they kind of stopped doing, like, the checks and stuff, people started stealing, and, you know, and then the crack came through. So I feel like, you know, so, like, if you have an idea that you get too big to, like, do, like, the floor work, then, you know, so, like, you might lose the reins a little bit, you know what I'm saying? So I could definitely relate to the negative sides of, like, oh yeah, I'm the boss, so I just stay up here, I work from home, I sign the checks, but then, like, you know, you stuff just slip by sometimes, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So, I know my uncle, he bought a big boat, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like, once you get to that level, I feel like it might be hard to kind of, see yourself, doing like the walkthroughs and stuff like that. But, he also, self-taught, high school dropout, 10 millions in sales like in the 70s. So he did all right, he did all right for himself. But, all right. So, so before we get out of here, I just want, everybody knows you. Everybody that I know.
For better or worse.
That I know, I've connect with so many people. There's a guy who lives in West Lynn named Mo, he knew you. He goes to the gathering. I actually saw him. I was talking to him I think last Wednesday when I was there. He's giving me game as well. So I appreciate all the old brothers, older brothers, hooking me up. But yeah, how did you get to a point where you're just such a an important part to our community? I feel like you're an important part to our community,
I think, my parents really ingrained in me that everything that we're able to accomplish, we never accomplish anything by ourselves, right? And so even if you're a solo founder, you've got a partner at home that's helping you make sure you're fed or you got time to go and do something. And I realized, when I was pretty young, I'm not going to live anywhere else. I'll go visit other places, but you'll never see me move out of Portland. And so if I know that I'm going to be here and be buried here in 50 years somewhere, God willing, I got to make good while I'm here. And I think part of what drives me is just, seeing the example that my parents laid, especially my dad. He was always doing stuff in community. He was on the board of Urban League and he was always involved with things. And I remember in the 80s, there was a climbing disaster that happened on Mount Hood. Oregon Episcopal School had students and some teachers up on the mountain and they got caught up there. And some of the folks actually passed away, but people had to go find them. And I remember coming home from school one day, my dad was packing his to-go bag. And I was like, where are you going? We're supposed to hang out. And he was like, I got to go to Mount Hood. These people are missing. And he said, I'll always remember this. He was like, well, in order for people to be found, someone's got to be looking for them. And so I'm going to go and look. And him and some of the people he was with, he and his group found some of the last people that were found alive. And that's always resonating with me. And so if I love this city and I love, supporting my community, I got to be willing to look for our folks, right? And find them, right? If this is a place that I say I'm invested in. And so when I think about community, I think about of course, soaking it up and going into good in the hood. But first and foremost, I think about what's my part? How am I putting in on this? Or am I just taking from it, right? And so when it comes to the gathering and Pitch Black and the other things that I do, that's my part of looking for folks and making sure that we're seen and making sure that folks, feel like we've really got, roots and a place here that we can really grow and do amazing things. And also expose our kids to being able to know they can do whatever they want right here. They don't have to go to Atlanta or DC or Detroit or wherever to go and accomplish what they want to accomplish. They can do all that right here because of the amazing community that we have. And the amazing connections. I think that's one of the other reasons why, I never want to leave here is, it's 0.3 degrees separation. I can know you, I can know Darkanian, I can know Ian and know everybody, right? But that's not the case in those other cities, right? And I also think authentically here, we want to see people be successful. And I don't know if that's the same in other cities. So.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Before I ask you the infamous top five sneakers question, mm-hmm. is there any last minute tips, tricks, inspiration, that you want to give to anybody who might be listening and might be able to connect with your story,
Yeah, no. I mean, for anyone who's thinking about, starting a business, the hardest thing to do is start. That's the thing that gets in the way of 80% of people is just starting. I think we're always, we always got a reason for why time isn't perfect or I don't know enough or I don't got enough money in the bank or whatever. But what you're missing out on is, you know, timing is the most important thing, having persistence. And so, you know, the thing that you're thinking about doing, get it started, even if you've only got it half baked. Get it started and go reach out to some people that are already in that space. Peer mentorship is, you know, the biggest underlooked thing in entrepreneurship. Go and talk to your competitors. They will put you up on game. Go and reach out to your competitor and say, what do you wish you would have known when you started your business? You know, they're going to tell you some amazing things. So, you know, get started, be authentic, and be really, really curious about what you're trying to build.
So, yeah, starting is definitely, but I feel like now I start too much. Like I have so many half-baked ideas.
That's great.
Sitting in the draft.
I just got to prioritize. Yeah, right. You just got to prioritize. No, I got like 3 business ideas in my head that continue to like swirl there, that I haven't done anything about yet. But I know they're just like bangers. Right. So no, that's good.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, you know, sneakerhead. I mean, I'm not really a sneakerhead. I don't feel like it, but you know, I just like sneakers. But right. You know, what I'm saying, like your top 5 shoes, maybe that you want, that you owned, that you sold, all, you know, ooh, however you want to, you know, saying, slice it up.
Yeah.
Just the top 5 overall.
Top 5. So, first one. Amamanir 3. I just think the story behind that shoe and materials, you know, the connection to the black company that helped create that. That's just it's on all fronts, just an amazing shoe. 4th one would be Air Max 95, great running shoe. When my wife and I first started dating in college, I got his and hers. So that one always comes to my mind. And just a great shoe, by the way. My top shoe of all time is the Air Zoom Flight 95, the basketball shoe. I'll never forget seeing that one for the first time on Isaiah Ryder's feet when he was playing for the Minnesota Timberwolves. My dad called me one day, freshman year of college, and was like, hey, I got tickets to the Blazer game. Come up and meet me. We went to the Blazer game, you know, had a great time together. And he was wearing those, and I was just like, that's it. And that's just an amazing shoe to ball in. Air Jordan 1 High. I mean, obviously, that's just the iconic shoe in so many other different ways you can put it together. I love the Defiant ones where the paint comes off. I've got a pair of those that just love those to death. And then lastly, I'd go with the question. Like, Allen Iverson is my favorite basketball player ever. I had cornrows in college, even after college, to my family's chagrin. You know, I remember the feeling of getting my first pair of those at Nordstrom's in the Salem Center Mall and just being like, okay, this is it. So I always got a couple pairs of those hanging around in the closet somewhere.
Okay. Now, did you get the original pair, like the black and white, or the black and blue, or the white?
Black and blue. Yeah. White and blue. Okay. That pearl blue. Yep. Oh yeah, I rocked the hell out of those playing intramural basketball in college. I beat the hell out of those things.
Okay. Yeah. For sure.
For sure.
Now you said the story behind the Amanir 3s. Were those the first ones that came out? I don't know too much about the story.
The 3s weren't the first ones. I believe they did another shoe before. I think they had another collab before that. But James, the owner, I've met him a few times. Really, really great brother. I met him through Pensole. Awesome materials. And I think that was the first one where it was actually a women's shoe. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was one that they really kicked off. I think really normalizing, like, no, we can make one specifically for the ladies. And if fellas want to try and get it, go and get it. And so that's just a perfect shoe. I got a pair that I haven't worn yet, but I'm gonna find a reason someday.
For sure. Okay. Well, brother, I appreciate you for connecting.
Yeah. What are your 5? Do we ever get to hear your 5 shoe?
Man, my 5 changes every day, but there are some cement threes cement threes, just because I just like the blocking, you know, saying the way they look. Jordan 1 highs, no matter what colorway, it's a dub. The kids, you know what I'm saying, the J kids.
Oh, the J kids? Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
The first ones, you know what I'm saying, the ones that kind of look like fly eyes, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
I had a pair of those, but I got rid of them because they hurt my feet, and that's like the worst
that's a KD Forest for me, like a great shoe where you're like, man, I just can't wear them, my feet just don't do it,
you know what I'm saying? It's like, man, I just want to wear these shoes, you know what I'm saying? But you know, I just couldn't, so I had to get rid of them. I felt the Aunt Pearl KDs, the one with the strap with the angel wings, the white ones. I think those were KD7s. Hurt my feet as well, but
yeah,
man, those was hard.
Look good,
right? You know what I'm saying? So like, those like probably like my favorite ones. Five. Let's go with the Action Bronson New Balance. It doesn't matter, but because it's gonna change. It's gonna change tonight. You know what I'm saying? But I do like that colorway. I like any kind of collab that like my favorite artist is doing, you know what I'm saying? Or like, you know, or if the colors is wild, you know what I'm saying? Like, I liked Khaled's collab, you know, Jordan 5, you know, people was hating on them, you know what I'm saying? I liked that. I kind of like the colors was different, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. The Nipsey Hussle 3s, you know what I'm saying? The Victory Lap 3s, I like them. But yeah, I feel like, and you know, people say, oh, you know, like, you know, your shoe collection should be broad, but it's like, I like Nikes, I like Jordans. I'm sorry.
Right. It is what it is. It is what it is. And also, I'm not sorry. Exactly.
You know, like, I wish I was well cultured and liked everything else. But, you know, you know what I'm saying? So, But, yeah, man, I appreciate you, brother. Oh, go ahead.
Of course. No, I was just going to say, like, I feel like the pinnacle, like, the shoe that really changed it for me was the 11. Like, seeing those on a shelf for the first time, like, that was like no other shoe. I don't wear them a lot, but I think that's a timeline shoe where there's a before and after in the game. It's definitely those.
Sure. I definitely appreciate the 11s, but I feel like we need to give those up. I feel like it's just time that we move on. Those are always the Christmas release and all that. People, like, we need to go ahead and give them away. I feel it though, you know what I'm saying? Because, like, you know, like, you know what I'm saying, that white patent leather, you know what I'm saying? Like, I remember seeing Damon Wayans hit the Heat wearing with suits. So many, right? Mm. I feel like everybody used to do that, you know what I'm saying? Because it's just a clean shoe. But as a culture, it's not.
The interesting thing about those is the 10s were actually supposed to have patent leather. But Jordan was like, nope, I do not like patent leather at all, but the 10s were originally supposed to be the first ones with patent leather, and he still didn't like the 11s, but he went with it on the 11s. So it's an interesting thing to see.
Now, I have seen a pair of sample 10s that look like they might have had some patent leather on them, like how, you know how like the 11 got that layer. Like, I feel like the sample 10s I saw had that layer on there, but
the first samples literally had patent leather, and he was like, nah, no patent leather, can't do it.
Then he switched up on his Jordan. But
Tinker won him over. Yeah.
And, well, you know, Tinker is a GOAT. You know, now, see, that's what I mean by raising my profile and interviewing people. Like, if I interview him, that'd be tight. You know,
so, he's an approachable. He's an approachable dude. I bet you could. You could pull that off.
It's like a 5-minute. It don't even have to be something. It's like, hey, man, you know what I'm saying? Just, you know, what were you thinking when you made this?
You know my boy Jeff Peart, he's got an amazing Tinker Hatfield story. He literally just saw him out in the street one day, and he's got a pair of Jordan 11s that Michael Jordan signed. And he used to work at a hotel, and he literally got fired for having Michael Jordan sign these shoes. But Jordan appreciated the hustle and how much planning he put into him being able to sign him. And one day he was out in the street, and he saw Tinker Hatfield, chatted with him briefly, and was like, hey, I've got this shoe that I'd love to show you. And so he's got a pair of Jordan 11s, which Tinker said he thinks are the only ones that exist that have both his signature and Michael's signature on them. But he's got a great story about those.
Retirement plan.
yeah, Yeah. Well, the story is probably better than what they're actually worth, but
For sure.
Yeah, how he got the two signatures is right. Super duper.
I'm sure somebody cares enough to be like, I need those. Just name the price. I need those, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, true.
But I know you are always approachable as well. You know what I'm saying? I had an idea the other day, and I was like, you know what? I should talk to Steven about that. But I feel like me and you have talked enough about, like, informational interviews that it's time for me to just do the damn thing. You know what I'm saying? I'm done asking. I'm done talking to you about things. I was like, well, eventually I'm going to have to do something. So, but I do appreciate, you stopping through and,
of course, bro.
Tell us about your story, the community. Like I say, everybody know you. I'm not kidding. Every black person that I see around. And we talk about something. If I say, yeah, you know Stephen Green, they'd be like, yeah, I know Stephen. So, you know, you just that just shows the important part of like when you mean like building community and building brands and building people. You know what I'm saying? You talk it like you walk it. So,
yes, sir. Down these streets. Down these streets.
Appreciate it. Well, I'll let you go ahead and enjoy the rest of your day. And, you know, I'll be in touch. You know, I'll see you. You know what I'm saying?
All right. Thanks, Chris. Have a good one, man.
Yes, sir. Peace.